Welcome back. Today we're going to spend a section at the beginning of lecture going over some clerical things about plans for the remainder of the course. So I'm going to spend some time talking about the design competition, which begins right now. Details of that are up on the website. You are going to work to design a converter meeting some minimum specifications while having high efficiency and minimizing size, and build and test that converter to prove out your analysis. So you can start forming teams for that. We're going to work in groups of 2 to 3, but the first assignment, the one that's going to start now, it's going to be due in 2.5 weeks, is an individual assignment. It's going to be analysis and design of some different topologies. So you'll do that all individually, and then with your team of 2 to 3, eventually select one converter to build and test. Right? And then the midterm, tentatively thinking the week of November 5th through 9th, that comes down to is how this part fits with this part. Okay? And I'll show a schedule, and that'll be open for comments or discussion. Okay. So this design challenge we call the Tiny Box Challenge. Those of you familiar, there was a couple of years ago a Google competition called the Little Box Challenge. So a lot of the format of this competition is kind of based on that. That was to design a 2-kilowatt inverter, but we're not going to be so ambitious here. So here's the specifications we're going to design to this year. It'll be a converter that takes 48 volts in, output 1.2 with some error bars of 100 millivolts, so that up to 12 watts, with minimal output ripple, high efficiency, specific constraint on the no load power loss. That is, if there is zero power at the output, can the thing continue running without blowing up? And then has a maximum volume, but should be well under that. Efficiency is going to be measured using the Tennessee Power Electronics efficiency, which is defined as a weighted sum of the efficiency at full power, 3/4 power, 1/2 power, and 1/4 power. And it's weighted with some relative weight, so that the maximum power is kind of more important, 0.25, 0.15, 0.1, so gradually less weighted towards the lighter powers, but still factor in. Okay. This is kind of a simplified version of CEC efficiency from the California Energy Commission, which is a common way to assess components in renewable energy systems, power electronics for solar. Okay. That one requires many more points. Too much to measure, so we define our own with only 4 points to measure. Okay. Some examples why these specifications might be relevant to real-world applications. Early in the course, first few lectures, we talked about 48-volt EV bus systems. And we did this example design of a 48 to 12, assuming we're converting between the 48-volt bus and the traditional 12-volt bus. Having a reasonably high power, 48 to 1.2, would allow us to power things like processors on the car directly from that 48-volt bus, remove more of the load from the 12-volt bus. Like we talked about before, now has hundreds of amps, needs really big cables, drop that current by a factor of 4 if we can move everything over to the 48-volt bus. Right. Additionally, this type of converter has a lot of interest right now in data centers, for really the same reason. Currently, a data center distribution comes in, particularly in telecom. There is some variability in this in data centers, but many of them will drop down, go from AC to DC, then to 48 volts, and distribute 48 volts to all of the individual server blades. And then onboard, drop that down to 12, distribute 12 across the motherboard, and eventually drop down to 1.2 volts for processors. Depending on the processor, might be slightly higher or lower, but in that 1.x range. Right? with the same arguments as over here, having a lot of distribution on 12 volts, we're getting into the hundreds of amps, approaching it through that 12 volt bus, which is causing a lot of I squared R type losses. It'd be better if we could push this 48 volts closer and have a single power stage that goes from 48 down to 1.2 right at the processor. Might be relevant later. This is generally called something like a mild hybrid EV. The mild hybrid really talks more about what you're doing with that additional bus, but with this 48 volt bus, oftentimes they're connecting things like starter generators for the engine in a hybrid system, or just start stop of an engine in a non-hybrid vehicle. Let's call it mild hybrid in that case. Data centers and telecom discussed is either 48 volt VRMs or 48 volt POL converters. This is voltage regulation module. POL is point of load converter. So both of these are kind of active research and development topics at the moment. A lot of work on designing different converters for this application, a lot of work on analyzing and system design for this application in EVs. So these are relevant designs. The difference from our spec is that, particularly in the data centers, this maximum output power would have to be much higher to be powering a processor. You're looking at something more in the 100 watts-ish range. We're keeping it low here for practicality of something we're going to build in a shorter time frame. Okay, so subject to meeting all of those constraints, the winning design is going to be the one that has the smallest volume. And volume is measured as the cube or three-dimensional rectangular space in which your power stage sits. Eventually, we're going to design circuit boards. You can put things outside of that volume as long as they're not critical to the operation of your converter. All of your switches, gate drives, passives components need to be within this volume. If you want some connectors for connecting signals, if you want some connectors for measurement, different things, you can put those outside. Throw something on the silk screen that indicates here's my actual power stage volume. Four, unless you make a real good case otherwise. The constraint there really is I'm going to fixed cost associated with your prototype. So you'll have some freedom to design around. If you want to go up to 6 layers, you can find that at a reasonable price. May take a hit on what you can spend on components. So there's going to be a fixed overall cost. That's posted on the website. I believe we're looking at $200 for PCB and $100 for components. I can't remember exactly what numbers they put in there. Okay. Per group. Okay, so segue into the full specifications are on the course website now. It went live this morning. Additional link up at the top for the Tiny Box Challenge. We are just looking at steady state open loop designs. There is no regulation requirement. You can test at full power at 12 watts and then shut it down, reprogram things for the correct duty cycles and phase shifts for the 9 watt point. Program, bring it back up, test at a different point. No requirement for any kind of control or sensing. I mentioned the first deliverable is going to be 2 weeks from Friday, which I'm going to ask you to run a design comparison of 3 different topologies that you think might be suitable for this application. I want you to do this individually. Okay? And that'll be due on a Friday, we'll have a reduced homework that week. But it is 2.5 weeks away. It's kind of a distributed assignment. Don't wait until the last minute, certainly. After this, you'll have your team formed, and everything henceforth would be as a team. So then you'll design the final circuit, do a PCB layout, get it back, populate, and test as a team. Okay. For this report due on the 26th, I want you to select three different topologies, evaluate them on, at minimum, efficiency at full power, power loss at zero load, output voltage ripple, and then volume of the main passive components, whatever they are. You can add additional analysis, whatever you think is necessary to be able to select between these. I'm going to constrain a little bit what topologies you select according to this table, again, posted online. So I want you to select at least one topology from class 3 and at least one topology from class 4, and then your third you can select from whatever. Okay? And these are arbitrary definitions of classes that I just made up. This isn't anything formal in the field. I'm saying class 1, kind of these traditional 481 type 2 switch converters, whether operated as resonant with high ripple or operated as hard switch and CCM, but the basic topologies, buck boost, sepik, zeta converter, juke, anything in there. Class 2, isolated variants of these, things like flyback, forward converter, push-pull, full bridge, operated traditionally. And then class 3 are these AC links that we're talking about now. In the next couple lectures, we'll talk about more variants of that. We talked about dual active bridge. You had a homework on dual active half bridge. We're going to go into series resonant converter today, LLC, these other things. And then class 4 is anything that's not in those. Okay. So kind of by definition are things we haven't really covered yet. So that's going to require, likely, unless you already know something you want to consider, looking through relevant literature and things like hopping on IEEE Explore. One reason why I wanted to give you these terms, these may be relevant search terms, to look at what other researchers are doing in this area. What sort of topologies are they using to achieve high performance? Okay. So this one, depending what you've been exposed to outside of class, may require going out and finding something else in papers or app notes. Okay. Some examples, switch capacitor, sigma delta type topologies, multi-level topologies, and a ton more exotic things. I'll ask that you act in good faith here. If it's a buck converter where I added an extra diode that doesn't really do anything, I'm not going to count that as really a different topology, right? Think of something that does have some significant difference from the basic things we've talked about. And then a third one, whatever you want. Can be another class 4, can be anything else. Okay. So yeah, say greater than or equal to 1 on these, and then no requirements on class 1 and 2. Okay. And then in this report, I'm gonna ask each of you to select one of those three and give kind of a full paper design of it. Say, here's what the devices are going to be, here's what the gate driver I'm going to use is, how I'm going to implement that, my passive devices, here's my selected switching frequency. A lot of this, likely you'll have considered in the comparison already. I just want you to pull together, okay, here's the one that I think is the best shot, and here's exactly how I go about designing it. And then in your group later, you'll look at, for the two or three of you, what are the ones you selected, and decide which one should be built. What I'll provide you with as we get towards the implementation is going to be a FPGA with a interface board on top of it that'll give you access to some PWM signals. So this interface board, and also I'll give you code for the FPGA that will generate PWM signals of arbitrary frequency and duty cycle. This is designed to signals for up to 8 devices. it's implemented as 4-4. So I have a bank of 4 PWM signals that are all tied to a common ground, and then 4 individual PWM signals that all have floating ground. That would be used to power things like high side floating devices. It would be all the grounded devices. If you need more than 8 devices or some different combination of grounded and isolated ground, we'll talk individually and figure out a method to do that. Yeah.
What is the FPGA?
Question is, what is the FPGA? It's a Mojo version 3 board, which is a combination of a microprocessor that handles USB communication and has some ADCs on it, likely not using anything with ADCs, and then a Spartan 6 FPGA. And like I said, I'm trying to reduce the burden there as much as possible, so I'll just give you a code that has 8 signals where you can set the frequency at a rising edge and falling edge of each of those signals. And can, for the most part, just use that and tweak the numbers to get the signals you need. Okay. Sure. If you want to use something else other than this, you're welcome. This is purely just to speed you up. You're going to be use anything else for control. You will still be constrained at the same timeline as everyone else, but you're welcome to as you like.
Okay. Yeah. So from our design, we're going to be going straight to
you. From your individual designs, you're going to have to get together with your group and select one design and then go straight to PCB, subject to, you'll have relatively limited time for PCB layout because it is just power stage, relatively simple, and should have defined it by there. But you're not, it won't be penalized if you tweak some things in between what you turned in and what you lay out. Those tweaks you believe are for the better. Okay. We need to do a thermal design. You do not need to do a thermal design. At 12 watts, achieve reasonable efficiency. You shouldn't have enough thermals in there to overheat anything. It's a good idea to consider and make sure that's true. But practically, if you're hitting 90% efficiency at full load, you just have 1.2 watts of loss, even in the relatively small devices that shouldn't overheat. So, no, you don't need to, in that we're not going to go over thermal design in the class, but it isn't a bad idea to consider that. Another question? Okay, so here's a rough schedule of main things. I ask that you select teams of 2 to 3 by next Monday. We won't have any deliverable for that. Just do it, and anybody who hasn't by next Monday, let me know. I may ask you to submit something just so I have record of who's in the team. That's, you know, great associated with that. And then we have this paper design and comparison due the 26th. And then the next week we'll have instruction of the PCB layout and the bill of materials, what components you want to order, and submission by that Friday. Point we'll fab them. And then you'll have, after about a week to fab these, have until the end of November to test and fill out a testing report on the results of that design. Okay. The testing report is meant to be really minimal. There's a template on the website, relatively little narrative associated with it. It's just plug in values for each of these tests, show me some waveforms, and give me a schematic of what you tested, some details on the implementation, enough to be able to assess the performance. Okay. So these times fall out, and this is somewhat open for discussion based on looking at the course schedule here. So this is October 26th, which is 2 weeks from Friday. We'd have that first report. Next week for PCB layout, And then midterm exam needs to fit in here somewhere. And my proposition to you is that we do the PCB layout, and then during this week, while those are off being manufactured, sometime do the midterm exam, and then have the remainder of November, probably get the boards back. Everything's on time, maybe November 9th, more likely November 12th. Have a couple weeks to populate and test those and get your results. How do people feel about that? Yeah, Jacob. Where are we going to do the testing? So most of you have access to sufficient equipment to do this testing already as part of your graduate studies. So for anybody who would prefer to do this testing at their own research bench, lab bench, you are welcome to. For anybody who does not want to or who requires additional resources, I'll coordinate with you individually and get you access to every piece of equipment you need to be able to complete this. So if you do need that, let me know sometime before the PCBs come back.
Will we have homework in addition to that first design comparison?
So that's in 2.5 weeks. We're going to have homework next week. We'll have a reduced assignment the week set up too. So I'll try to scale homework according to what's going on. This competition is going to run from now till the end of the semester, synchronously with, we're going to continue lecturing on kind of theoretical topics in class. We're going to continue having homeworks, but I will try not to have large homework assignments due at the same time that you're doing significant work on the competition. Won't guarantee any times that I'm going to completely drop a homework, but I will reduce it if it's weeks that you have a lot to do on the competition. And throughout the remainder of the semester, as with the semester up till now, I welcome any feedback on that. You guys can tell me before the due date of an assignment that you think it's too much. We can talk about it and adjust due dates, adjust scope of work. But just don't come on a Friday, 10 minutes after it was due, and say, we should extend the deadline. But otherwise, I'm open to comments on workload. Other questions? How do people feel about this schedule? There is a final. And that'll be week after. Yeah. December 5th, I think, is the start of finals or is study day.
And you said we were just essentially doing the power stage?
Right. So you'll have, talk in greater detail about this as we get towards it. So at the moment, the design kind of on paper. But this will handle the generation of all the signals. It'll also give you supplies for all of those gate drivers. It's got isolated supplies and PWM signal with LDOs on here to give you whatever voltage you need up to 15 or 12, I don't recall. But can LDO that down using this. So it can give you the supply and the signal for your gate driver. You'll have to put the gate driver on your board. Moving the gate driver off to another board is potentially disastrous for operations. You have to have that in there as part of your power stage. So it'll be gate drivers, transistors, passive components all together. Anything else you want on there for testing and measurement. Dissenting comments on the schedule? Anybody concerned by this? What's the form of the midterm? My inclination is to make it take home, just because you've seen enough homework problems from me now that have kind of longer thought-inducing design elements to them, that giving you an in-class midterm, you'd see a somewhat different type of problem to be able to do it in a couple hours rather than over a week. But I'm open to suggesting that people are strongly averse to a take-home, we can do an in-class one. That's the only caveat there being just those problems will, by necessity, not me being malicious, but they'll have to be a little bit different. I'll try, it'll cover the same stuff. It'll cover the things we did in class. There won't be any, oh, you don't remember this one comment I made? It'll be the main topics. But just that be able to get through 2-3 problems in a limited amount, a couple hours. We do it in the evening. It would have to be written a little bit differently than what you've seen on homeworks. If you do a take-home, it can be more similar to the homework problem. Ask a little bit more of you, be a little bit more comprehensive, it'll be the same type of thing. You're not concerned about that. Like I said, I'm open either way.
What kind of time span would we have for a take-home?
We did. 4 hours? No, a week.
Okay.
And what I would likely do is, if we stick to this schedule, once I have all the layouts submitted, I'll send it out so that we kind of parse out. I don't have people trying to scramble on a midterm and doing CCB layout. And then we can stick to the schedule and get everything in on Friday, send it out Friday, have it due the next Friday. If people are, significant numbers of groups are eking out into the weekend and behind on PCB layout, then we'd hold off on giving out the midterm until maybe a Monday. But you'd have at least the week to do it, similar to a homework. And there'd be no homework that week. So we can move things around a little bit here if people have preferences. What's nice about this, like I said, is that then we'd be doing the midterm while we're waiting for PCBs to get manufactured, which lets us kind of double use some time. If we flip things here, then we got to, you know, take a break from the competition to do the midterm and get back to it, which is kind of why I arranged it this way. Previously, I'd said roughly the week of the 29th. This looked like it would work a little better. Again. No other comments or concerns? Everybody okay with this? Everybody quiet and raging?
I usually prefer your take-home exams because I felt like with that period of time, I'm able to really teach myself the material. So I'm with what you've usually done. I'd be happy to teach you that.
You always say that before and then afterwards. You say, oh, well, shit.
One is
not gonna matter. It'll be equally difficult either way. Which hopefully is zero difficult because you guys mastered the material. That's incredulous looks I got. Okay. Let's go with this then. If you have any major concerns that you don't want to voice here in class, you can email me and let me know. We'll kind of take those into consideration. Otherwise, we'll do that. We'll do a take home. We'll stick to this schedule. Final concluding comments on that before we jump back into DAB. Okay, good luck. Design me a really good converter. So, last time we kind of concluded on the dual active bridge converter, finished solving it out, and then looked at some examples from literature of different design considerations and example prototypes of this dual active bridge. Today we're going to transition into a series resonant converter, and I'm going to do so by way of discussing a kind of practical issue in the dual active bridge, which is transformer saturation. You'll see here I've drawn the dual active bridge with an additional capacitor. Use this schematic from later, but I'm going to call this C infinity. This is just some very large capacitor. And the reason this may be needed is without this capacitor, what I have is essentially two kind of square wave voltage sources applied to this tank with a transformer in here. And as we analyze the DAB, then this is more or less an ideal transformer. I don't have to consider much about it. Okay. If we look at a practical transformer, what it'll have, well, it'll have some leakage inductance. That leakage inductance would just be in series with LL, add to it, wouldn't change the operation any. It'll have some magnetizing inductance, LM, which typically I can design to be orders of magnitude larger than the leakage. And so it won't do a whole lot in the operation of this DAB. If I design that magnetizing inductance very large, I'll have some triangular current going through it, but because the impedance is so much larger than LL, it'll be really small in magnitude, only nominally alter the waveforms. But the strain of it is when I start considering real transformer with magnetizing inductance, I can saturate it. So I need to be able to guarantee that I don't have any DC applied to this transformer, or else I'll saturate transformer, this magnetizing current, even though very small triangular amplitude, if I have DC applied, it'll gradually run away to infinity. Right? And I can have that happen very easily if I just have, for example, well, really any asymmetry in the operation of this. One way it can happen is, what if I just kind of have some error in my modulation signals and my VF, my secondary side voltage, isn't exactly 50% duty cycle, 51% duty cycle. If that happens, if I average over one period, VS waveform is also the voltage on the magnetizing inductance, if I'm looking from the secondary, reflect it through either way. If I average over this thing now, I'll get some DC component. I'll have an average voltage over the switching period, which means that my current in the magnetizing inductance is going to build up and gradually run away. Whole thing will fall apart. So I can't let that happen. So I need to, in the design of any DAB, I need to prevent transformer saturation. And there are a few ways I can do that. One is implementing some kind of current control. And to really be sure, I need to put a current sensor on the primary side of the tank and on the secondary side of the tank. If I build up some huge magnetizing current, it's going to split in some way and it can flow either to the primary or the secondary. If I sense these two currents and make sure neither of them have any DC components, then I can't have some large DC magnetizing current. I can put current sensors and put some kind of control to make sure, if I do have a little bit of DC applied, adjust my duty cycles and get rid of that to bring the magnetizing current back down to zero. Another one, we're not going to talk a lot about it here. There's some interaction between the zero voltage switching of each bridge and the volt seconds applied to the tank, being that if there is some additional DC current in the magnetizing inductance, that will affect my switching transition, cause them to speed up, and that speed up will apply counteracting volt seconds to the tank, which can compensate to a limited extent some error in modulation. Okay? So there is some ZVS dynamics can compensate this to a limited degree. That works if what we call T alpha and T delta large within one switching period. That large means is that my waveforms don't look like this, or I have near square waves. They look like some long resonant transition that takes up maybe 10% of the period. Just mention that. We're not going to get into the details of that phenomenon. But by far, the easiest and most common way is to just put a DC blocking cap. Which now is this C infinity that I've inserted. And if I really want to be careful, I put C infinity over 2 and then another one over here. I'm calling it C infinity because I just want a really big cap there. As long as it's sufficiently big, I don't really care what the value is. I'm trying to design it big enough that all the frequencies in play and what's going on in one switching period, it just looks like a short. But as I go back to DC it looks like some impedance. When everything else here, all the inductances become short, that looks like an open, and it'll block any DC applied to the tank. Okay. If I had this kind of situation, I'd see this total area divided by TS volts show up on that cap. It would block it and prevent that DC from being applied to the transformer. Okay. So this C infinity is large such that within one switching period, the ripple on it is zero. That means relative to the analysis I've done is that this resonance between C infinity and LL, the resonant frequency 1 over C infinity LL, and that frequency is way less than my switching frequency. There is a resonance, but it's at a frequency so low, below all of my frequency content for my modulation, it's not going to get excited. It's not going to do anything. Okay. When I look at frequencies above resonance, I just see the inductance. Way back at DC, I just see the capacitance. Okay. Like I said, this is very commonly done in dual active bridge converters. As you're building up, prototyping, just throw a couple of caps in there to make sure the transformer doesn't saturate. Like I said, one example is if your modulation is off a little bit, you'll always have some there. Your modulation here is not going to be 50% duty cycle to infinite precision. Always have some sort of variability there. And because any sort of DC applied to a transformer integrates up, even with a very small amount of error, you can over time integrate up to a really huge current. It may take millions of periods, but if you're switching in a megahertz, that's a couple seconds. Right. Can also happen even if you have ideal waveforms exactly timed perfectly. If there's any asymmetry in the circuit, for example, if this device has higher on resistance than this device, that will cause different voltage drops on them when current flows through them, which will cause some distortion of this VP signal. Again, very small distortion, but it integrates over time, cause things to run away. Okay. So throw some caps in, it'll be fine. Then if I'm looking at this, my question becomes, how necessary is this constraint? If I am putting a cap in the tank, what would happen if I allowed the infinity to get a little bit smaller and actually approach a situation where it's kind of resonant frequency in the tank is close to the switching frequency? It turns out that's not a terrible idea. And when you do that, what you get is called the series resonant converter, which looks completely different. Not really, it's just the same thing. The only difference is CR, this capacitance, is now not designed to be purely a DC block, but it's designed to be a series resonant filter near the switching frequency. Okay. So in the series resonant converter, 1 over 2 pi root CRLL is approximately equal to the switching frequency. And what that's going to do is give me waveforms that, even outside of the switching intervals of these dead times, are significantly resonant. So here I have the inductor current and capacitor voltage waveform operating at a frequency slightly above, at a switching frequency slightly above the resonant frequency. You can see they look pretty similar to what I had for the DAB. They'll have kind of trapezoidal inductor current. But now superimposed on top of that is resonant sinusoidal type waveforms. Okay. Now, alter our analysis, alter a number of characteristics, but the underlying mechanism is still pretty similar to the DAB. Look at what operating in this series resonant mode would look like. I'm going to reference the publication here at the bottom. It does a pretty comprehensive comparison of dual active bridge and series resonant converters. So this slide shows the waveforms for dual active bridge and series resonant operation. Here they're really considering it as one converter and then just altering things like the ratio of the resonant frequency to the switching frequency. This paper defines this FR over FS, which is in our notation 1 over F. We define capital F, or normalized switching frequency, as FS over F naught, the inverse of that. If this goes to zero, it means my resonant frequency is very small, my switching frequency is very high. So this is DAB operation up here. And then down here at a ratio of 0.95, my switching frequency is just slightly greater than my resonant frequency. So this would be SRC type operation, series resonant converter. Going left to right, the columns are for larger phase shifts, which are going to correspond to higher powers. And then within each plot, there's three different conversion ratios. So the solid lines is Vout is equal to NVG. Big dash is Vout greater than NVG. Small dash is Vout much greater than NVG. First, looking at DAB, the inductor current has this kind of trapezoidal waveform that we've looked at. You go to higher phase shifts, we spend more time in this ramping interval, get up to a higher peak, eventually a very large phase shift. And as I start changing the voltage conversion ratio, I get this kind of ramping superimposed on top of that due to, in this power delivery interval, the voltages on the inductor aren't matched. They're a little bit different, so I have some steady state ramping. Okay. When I go to the SRC, inductor current waveforms look pretty similar, save for that they've just all been kind of rounded off by this resonance. A couple ways to think about that. You can think about that as the resonant behavior of it. You can think about that as, well, this is a series resonant, which is going to block harmonics away from the switching frequency. So the fundamental, the switching frequency part, is going to pass through relatively unfazed, but the harmonics of that are going to get attenuated. So it'll look kind of like a just a filter, a bandpass filter at the switching frequency. In either event, the waveforms we get. Okay. Largely similar, lower harmonic content, in some cases, kind of smaller currents available for soft switching, some other trade-offs we'll talk about on the next slide. So here are a bunch of metrics to compare these two. And they're given names in this paper. I'm just going to tell you what they are. So the top here, get this out of the way. Maybe. Just put it more in the way. So this is just output power. ST is voltage applied to the transformer times the current through the transformer, where both these are RMS values, a measure of kind of the power processed by the transformer. And then ST over P is just normalized transformer power. It's a measure of, you know, the power stress of this transformer, which kind of implies how large I'd have to make it to get a reasonable amount of loss. Okay. T star is normalized transformer voltage. Which would imply kind of what is the size constraint related to saturation of this thing. Capital IL, their notation is a little different from ours, but this is RMS inductor current. And then ILTHD, the total harmonic distortion of the tank current, is kind of what's the spectrum look like? How well are harmonics attenuated? What's the high frequency content of that waveform? Okay. And then columns, on the left is the DAB, on the right are two cases of the series resonant converter designed either with the resonant frequency very close to the switching frequency or a little bit further away. There's a lot of information here. Look through. I'm just going to jump to conclusions here. Again, drawn from this work. So these are the conclusions of the authors of this paper. The DAB allows you to operate with a smaller, you know, physically resonant tank. Looked at for the DAB, what are the constraints on the inductance design? It needs to be small to keep low conduction loss. It needs to be large to get CVS, have small switching loss. Can have smaller RMS currents because I don't have this superimposed sinusoid resulting in a little bit higher peaks because of the sinusoidal nature of it. It can be very close to square wave current almost, which was that the ultimate converter idea. Okay, it can have peak stresses equal to the average input and output current. SRC, even at that nice V out is equal to NVG, is going to have the sinusoid imposed on top of it. Okay. And then the DAB, particularly with some of these different modulation schemes that we talked about, can be controlled to have a wider soft switching range. SRC, series resonant converter, has some advantages, particularly in the design of the magnetics. By having that resonant type behavior, it gets rid of a lot of the harmonics, has a nice nearly single frequency current going through the tank, which can reduce winding losses of the magnetics in the tank. It can also potentially reduce turnoff losses. These turnoff losses, we're talking about things that we called overlap losses during turnoff. This, how is my inductor current compared to my gate current? With the SRC, because of the sinusoidal nature, I have lower current when the devices turn off for the same average output. It'll allow me to turn off with lower overlap losses on turnoff if I can't drive my gate driver fast enough to make those negligible. And then in specific cases, SRC will do a lot better if I need to have a large inductance. For whatever reason dictated by the design, when I go to a very large inductance for the DAB, I end up with really high RMS current. SRC, I can have that same large inductance, put a capacitor in series with it, cause that impedance at the switching frequency to drop and still be able to operate. Whereas on the DAB, I'd have a really slow ramp, wouldn't be able to operate at the switching frequency I want. Okay. Any questions on that? What we're going to do next is do a state plane for the series resonant converter and actually solve it. Just kind of introduction. What is this converter good for? How does it compare to what we've been doing? Man on time. Okay. So here I'm going to go through and sketch subinterval equivalent circuits. In each case, the tank is going to stay the same, and I'm going to simplify the primary and secondary bridges according to the switching state that the converter is in. Okay. In order to do this, I am going to make a few assumptions or approximations about the operation of this thing that may initially be somewhat counterintuitive. So in the DAB, the resonance that I was focused on in my analysis was the resonance between the tank inductance and the device capacitances. I looked at that, and the system was really only resonant during the dead times of the bridges. When the bridges were on, it was just a voltage source applied to the tank. Okay. So I didn't have this capacitance, my resonant capacitance was at DP, it was the capacitance of the devices. Now my dominant resonance is going to be this resonance. And if I want to prevent the thing from having multi-resonant frequencies, I don't have a good way to account for the bridge capacitances. So as an initial approximation, what I'm going to do is I'm going to neglect the capacitance of any of the devices. I'm going to solve assuming all of my switching devices are ideal, no capacitance, and switch instantaneously. Okay. And then go back and look at how good of an approximation was that. Why can I make it? it's a common thing to do, particularly in very high power converters where these switching intervals are going to be nearly instantaneous, and I have more or less square wave type voltages. Okay. So I'm going to make that approximation. I'm going to go through and solve. I'm going to end up with voltage sources on either side of this tank. I'll be able to sketch a state plane that's just a single state plane for JL and MR. Solve it, examine the operation theory it doesn't convert, and we'll do that on Friday. Okay. Thanks, guys.